This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John le Carré, is famous for his spy novels, but his writing has been praised for transcending genre fiction and simply being great literature. Many of his books were adapted into films or TV series, including The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and The Night Manager. Before writing espionage novels, le Carré was a spy. He worked for Britain's domestic intelligence service, MI5, and its foreign intelligence service, MI6. He was still working for MI6 when his third book, the Cold War novel The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, became an international bestseller. One of the characters in that novel, George Smiley, became the main character in several of le Carré's later books. In his recent memoir, The Pigeon Tunnel, le Carré wrote about creating the character of Smiley. Smiley is back in le Carré's new novel, A Legacy of Spies. The main character, Peter Gwillem, had been a protege of Smiley's. In the new novel, Gwillem is retired, but he's forced to re-examine actions he took when he was a spy during the Cold War, actions that may have cost the lives of two people who were close to him. John le Carré, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's begin with a reading from your new novel, A Legacy of Spies. Would you read the first page for us?
Sure. What follows is a truthful account, as best I'm able to provide it, of my role in the British deception operation codenamed Windfall that was mounted against the East German Intelligence Service, Stasi, in the late 1950s and early 60s, and resulted in the death of the best British secret agent I ever worked with, and of the innocent woman for whom he gave his life. A professional intelligence officer is no more immune to human feelings than the rest of mankind. What matters to him is the extent to which he is able to suppress them, whether in real time or, in my case, 50 years on. Until a couple of months ago, lying in bed at night in the remote farmstead in Brittany that is my home, listening to the honk of cattle and the bickering of hens, I resolutely fought off the accusing voices that from time to time attempted to disrupt my sleep. I was too young, I protested. I was too innocent, too naive, too junior. If you're looking for scalps, I told them, go to those grand masters of deception, George Smiley, and his master, Control. It was their refined cunning, I insisted, their devious scholarly intellects, not mine, that delivered the triumph and the anguish that was Windfall. It is only now, having been held to account by the service to which I devoted the best years of my life, that I am driven in age and bewilderment to set down, at whatever cost, the light and dark sides of my involvement in the affair.
You know, in the reading, your character refers to, you know, being expected or having to suppress human feelings to be a spy, and he later thinks that George Smiley, your most famous character who recruited your narrator, suppressed the humanity in him. Do you feel like when you were working for British intelligence that you had to suppress human feelings or suppress your humanity?
Well, of course, in any corporate or institutional situation, people who are employed by those corporations have to repress their feelings in one way or another. We, during the Cold War, were aware of suppressing our human instincts in some directions, but for a cause, a great cause, as we thought. And it seemed expedient that a few should suffer for the benefit of the many. At the moment, as the present is described in the novel, we are mysteriously unfocused, still looking for some kind of identity. Really, ever since the end of the Cold War, there was no Marshall Plan, there was no great visionary or leader who told us how the world should be reshaped. There was drift, and a lot of carpetbaggers went and picked at the Soviet carcass. And really, it was like a long after-lunch sleep of capitalism. And that's really what we've drifted into, without a design of the new world.
But getting back to what I asked, did you feel like you had to suppress your humanity to be a good spy?
Yes, I did. In the greater cause, I felt I had to suppress my humanity. Where I was asking people to do things, I tried to persuade them that they were doing it for the greater good, and I was doing it for the greater good. Where I had to deceive people, I felt I was doing that for the greater good too. But then you get alongside the borderline of how much of this stuff can we do and remain a society that is worth protecting.
Do you look back on your career in intelligence and regret anything that you did?
Yes, I do. I regret in my student days posing as a crypto-communist and trying to attract Soviet recruiters in those days. I was sort of half successful. I got picked up and flirted with by a Russian recruiter in the Soviet embassy in London, and it all came to nothing. Perhaps I wasn't clever enough, or perhaps I was compromised by somebody else. But in the course of posing as that person, I had to sign up as some kind of secret communist, and that meant deceiving my colleagues and my fellow students. And looking back on that, I feel very queasy about it. And then I ask myself how much worse it must be now for people attacking the Islamist target, and how grim by comparison, and how severe the possible outcomes would be.
So what made you feel queasy was deceiving people who you know pretending to have opinions and beliefs that you did not have in order to entrap people.
Yeah, but if you think of it, in the larger sense, if you drop a bomb, you kill people you don't know. Mm-hmm. If you kill them with a knife, you kill somebody you do know. It is the human encounter that makes the act unbearable or places a great strain on one's conscience or one's sense of decency. If you're sufficiently detached from it, it becomes a statistic, it becomes a military act. But face to face, the lies straight into the face, the befriending, the false befriending, and those things they're demeaning in a sense. They diminish one's sense of self. And actually, in some rather sad way, I did what I think was probably in the end the right thing. We expect intelligence services to deliver, but then when we're asked to get our own hands dirty, we get squeamish about it.
Because you've written so many novels set during the Cold War, you met two heads of the KGB. You were in Russia twice, once during the Soviet era, communist era, and then once in 1993 when the oligarchs and the criminals had kind of taken over. And you wrote about the Cold War. Nothing, absolutely nothing, is what it seems. Everyone has a second motive, if not a third. I'm wondering how that applies to trying to figure out what's happening now in terms of possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia and Russia's interference in the U.S. election and in other elections as well. You know, the whole idea is like nothing is what it seems. Do you think that's still the case? And if so, like, how are you trying to understand what Russia has been up to?
Well, a whole bunch of questions.
I know, that's really terrible. I committed an interviewer's
Let's look first of all at the operation influence, if you like, and how that's exerted. What we suspect the Russians are doing, not only in the United States, but they did in Britain for the referendum, maybe in Britain for the election. They certainly interfered in Macron's election in France. Mm-hmm. So who are these forces? And what is really spooky, I think, and profoundly disturbing, is they come from the West as well as the East. That there are oligarchs in the West who are so far to the right that they make a kind of natural cause with those on the other side of the world. Both of them have in common a great contempt for the ordinary conduct of democracy. They want to diminish it. They see it as their enemy. They've made a dirty word of liberalism, one of the most inviting words in politics. And so they're closing in on the same target from different points of view. That's the first thing. So whether they're called Cambridge Analytica or whether they've got some spooky name and they're hidden away in the Ukraine, they're actually doing much the same job. They're undermining the decent processes of democracy. And that's having its effect. It's had its effect in Europe, in Hungary, in Poland, and I think it's had a quite disturbing effect in my own country. We'll come to that later. Now, as to what is happening in the other areas of Russian behavior and Mr. Trump's association, there I think we follow the money trail. I think it's perfectly possible that Trump was taken into what I call a honey trap, that he had ladies found for him and he misbehaved in Russia. I don't think if that film was shown tomorrow worldwide, Trump would get away with it. People would say, well, boys will be boys, or they would say the different parts of the body in the video don't add up. This is all fake stuff. And 35 experts would testify to that. So it wouldn't get any distance on that. But on the money, that's a deep and persistent theme in Trump's business affairs. It's gone on for a long, long time. It relates also to a great extent to property held in the United States, which brings the thing closer to home. And it relates also to Mr. Trump's family.
Do you think following the money is an especially good course because of the power of oligarchs and in Russia?
The power of oligarchs in Russia, what the oligarchs have lent Trump directly or indirectly for his enterprises, the protection they've given him in far places, but none of that will play so well for the downfall of Trump as the domestic stuff, as the properties that he owns around America, how they've been bought, who they've been bought by, in what sums, whether the sums were actually consonant, whether they were gross, whether they look like some kind of backhander or bribe, and the extraordinary number of Russians with criminal records or Eastern Europeans with criminal records who frequent Trump's company. In the end, it seems to me, some of this has got to come home to roost. And I think there might be a point, I hope there will be a point, when somebody goes to Trump and says, your family is so deeply involved in this that you have a choice. You either fade away or we disrupt the House of Trump in ways that would be very painful to you.
There's also the Russian dossier, which says that the Russians have compromising material on Donald Trump. In this case, part of the compromise is a video that's alleged to reveal that President Trump watched certain sexual acts. What's your knowledge of compromise? Did you have any direct encounters with that?
Well, first of all, let's remember that Putin, when he was running the KGB from Dresden in East Germany, was a master of compromise. So when he wanted to obtain a Western diplomat, a Western official, a target of some kind, he would surround them, he would tempt them, he would set stuff up, he would fake a background they couldn't deny, whatever it was. That's an old skill that goes back hundreds of years, not just in Russia, but the Russians specialized in it, even in Tsarist times. And the Grey Tsars of today are experts at it. They love it. They love the complexity of it. They love the chess game of it. That I don't think it would work. So I think the compromise, if it's taken place, has taken place very largely through Trump's own endeavors to raise money in all sorts of dark places. And together, all those efforts amount to a self-compromising activity, which the Russians have embraced. I think they have him by the short hairs.
So you suggest that in terms of your earlier career as a spy in England, that since your father was a liar, that you knew how to lie and invent personalities, that came naturally to you. You say your father was a con man, an occasional fantasist, an occasional jailbird, a crisis addict, a performance addict, a delusional enchanter who wrecked a lot of people's lives. And you say he had absolutely no relationship to the truth. So do you feel like you picked up certain skills, so to speak, from being his son?
Look, it begins, first of all, every child believes that the parents he's given are the world. I was left with one parent at the age of five. My mother disappeared. And after that, it was living in the wake of this maverick fellow who often was enchanting for a long time. That was my world. Then, as I began to realize the problems it had, I was also very much concerned to survive. It's about survival. You become watchful. You know, I spent a lot of time, if he left the house, going through his pockets and things, trying to find out what was going on. We were displaced repeatedly by angry debtors. For quite long periods, he was on the run. He was on the run in the United States, even, wanted by the forces of the law. And he filled my head with a great lot of truthless material, which I found it necessary to check out as a child with time. So, yes, I mean, in that sense, these were the early makings of a spy. But that was about how children survive. And then his great passion, which he achieved, was to turn me into a seeming gentleman. We were working class. All my family spoke with decent regional accents, went to church very regularly, and were simple people living on the south coast of England. And he broke away from that completely. And so from the age of 5 to the age of 16, I was in private schools, in boarding schools, and in holiday times mainly, at other holiday homes and things like that. And out of that period, I suppose, I learned the language, I learned the gestures, I learned the mindset of the upper middle classes. And somehow, more or less, my father paid for that so-called education. But that really is how backgrounds are made. You know, we grow up as we are born, we fight the wars we inherit, and then at a certain time in our lives, we begin to question things we were, who we were, and things we did. That seems a natural process. Mine, it was acute because I gave myself my services to my country from quite early and then thought about it afterwards.
Are you saying that when you were young and growing up as a person of more means than your family actually had, that you felt fraudulent?
I'm quite certain I felt that I belonged to a fraudulent outfit, because often my job was to humor creditors, tell them the money was in the post, as it were, whether they were tradesmen or whether they were neighbors or whether they were close friends, suddenly worried my father had fleeced them.
Your father made you do that?
Yes, I suppose you could say he made me do it. I obliged him. You know, you only have one person to love if you have one parent.
So he kind of made you his partner in crime?
When I was adolescent, yes, he did. Yes, and then I revolted against that, and I guess that's how the schism between us began, and it continued thereafter. I think from my age, sort of 18, 19, by then, I was on the run from him and really trying to weaken the ties and finally to cut them altogether, which was what happened.
Can you describe more what that revolt against your father was like, what shape it took?
It was asking him for certain truths, why things had happened in our lives, why do we have to move house so suddenly, why have we sold the house, why have the bailiffs removed my possessions, and then why are we frightened, why have we hidden the car at the back of the house, put out all the lights, why we're not answering the telephone. And the reason why was that he had fallen foul of what you would call the mob, the criminal syndicates that he was occasionally involved with. And they were cross with him. He was much more frightened of them than he was of the police. So I, at some point, I think there were several points, I faced him and shouted at him and demanded to know what the truth was about his life, and he became very angry. And they were all arguments with no outcome. They were just little battles, but the war just ran on. And then it became impossible when, after the spy came in from the cold and I made money, he wanted it, the money.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And we'd never had any money in the family. and I had been, until that, all that happened, I'd been first of all a quite impoverished married schoolmaster, and then finally in government service, slightly better off, but still every gas bill, every electricity bill counted. And then this flood of money from a bestseller, and he wanted to latch onto it, and he didn't say give it to me. What he had was all these wonderful schemes, and I was an absolute fool on two counts. Firstly, to pay tax, because he could assure me that wasn't necessary. And secondly, not to invest in his enterprises, which were all pretty crazy. And in the end, they all came to nothing.
So you protected yourself against him when you started to have bestsellers and he wanted your money? You succeeded in protecting yourself?
Yes, I didn't give him the money. I made him various offers at one time or another to set him up, put him in a house, and pay his grocery bills. But he was an extremely proud man and had his own ways of surviving. Anyway, and when he died, he had a house in Jermyn Street, a house in Tite Street, Chelsea, a house in the countryside, a third wife, and we couldn't find anywhere a penny piece to keep any of it going. It was all one of the great mysteries of life, and he'd been for many of his years undischarged bankrupt. But just in this last surge of seeming affluence, he'd put the whole card house together again. And in the moment of his death, it all fell apart. There was absolutely nothing anywhere. The cupboards were everywhere bare.
Did you inherit his debts?
Not in law, no. I inherited them morally, I suppose.
It sounds like when you were a child, you had to basically develop a persona. As a spy, you have to develop a persona. Was it ever hard for you to figure out who your authentic self was?
Writing did that for me. The moment I realized that I could write, that my imagination could be harnessed and disciplined and applied to the business of writing, I knew I had a life in front of me, and a truthful life, and one that I could really carry with me to the end of my life.
John le Carré, David Cornwell, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. Thank you.
John le Carré's new novel is called A Legacy of Spies. His memoir, The Pigeon Tunnel, was published last year. You know that feeling when you envy a friend because they're more successful than you, or you think they have a better life than you do, and that jealousy hits you in an almost physical way, even though you know better? That kind of envy is what the new film Brad Status is about. It was written and directed by my guest Mike White, who also created the HBO series Enlightened, wrote the films School of Rock, Nacho Libre, and Beatrice at Dinner, and wrote and directed Year of the Dog. Brad Status stars Ben Stiller as Brad, a husband and father taking his son to visit the colleges he's applied to, including Harvard and Tufts. The college trip gets Brad thinking about his college friends who have become much more successful than he has. He runs a nonprofit organization. They're wealthy and are big names in their fields. We get to know what Brad is thinking through a series of voiceovers, like this one from the beginning of the film. Brad is tossing and turning in bed, questioning choices he's made in life, and feeling like a failure compared to his old college friends.
So many friends from college have become successful. Nick Pascal was a big movie director in Hollywood, living this crazy, decadent life. Jason Hatfield had his own hedge fund, obscenely rich. Owns three houses. A big philanthropist. Billy Wurstler sold his tech company at 40. He's already retired, living a life of leisure in Maui. Craig Fisher worked for the White House. He's written all these bestsellers, always on TV.
Thank you.
It's stupid to compare lives. But when I do, I feel somehow I failed. And over time, these feelings get worse.
That's Ben Stiller in Mike White's new movie, Brad Status. Mike White, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love the film. Why did you want to write about jealousy and always measuring your accomplishments against those of college friends who are more famous and more successful?
I felt like I was wanting to write about status anxiety, and I find that I sometimes, lie at night, not necessarily in a jealous place, but I do feel like I have a relationship to my sense of where I stand in the world. I wished I had been more successful. I don't know. And I find when I'm in that kind of frame of mind, it's so embarrassing to talk about with other people. And because I find it like a side of myself that is just so not cool about it, that I was like, maybe there's something to unpack here.
And, in your life, you're successful, you've made movies, you've had an HBO series, and you could probably measure yourself against people who are far less successful than you, who you knew from school, and other people who have franchise films now and have made a fortune several times over.
Yeah. It's funny because I gave the script to Ben Stiller, who's the star, and he is, if anyone's successful in our business as a contemporary of mine, he's a few years older, but it's Ben Stiller, he's had a huge Hollywood career. And he was like, I so relate to this character.
You cast yourself in the role of one of Ben Stiller's friends who's become very successful in Hollywood as a director. His Malibu mansion is on the front page of Architectural Digest. And Stiller's character imagines this friend getting married, marrying the man he loved, because there just has been a wedding to which the Stiller character wasn't invited. And in this fantasy that he has of that wedding, each of these two men are smearing wedding cake on the other's face. And it's so much it's fun and funny and romantic all at the same time. And he's so jealous. Meanwhile, he's in a wonderful marriage himself.
Right. Well, I think comparative anxiety, and he says it in the movie, but it's definitely a waste of time and energy. But I think it's just something that happens in, it's a universal situation. But I also think that now more than ever with social media and the way you can access people's lives through Googling each other or getting on Instagram, that you're just kind of more aware of the curated lives of your contemporaries. And I think that that creates this sense of anxiety or a sense of lack. And feeling is somebody's vacation better than mine? Or is someone having a better life than mine? And it is a high-end problem and absurd, but it is something that I think people contend with.
Do you follow people on social media and do that kind of comparative thing?
I try not to, but I at one point I was on Instagram and I had followers and followed a lot of people and was active on it. And then I started hating people that I actually like in real life just because of the way that they were sort of presenting themselves through Instagram. And then I was like, I don't want to feel this way about these people. And then I started realizing that I was looking at my own kind of curated Instagram page and I was like, gosh, I'm sure there's times where I'm on some nice vacation or doing something fun and somebody's sitting in some dark room who's a friend of mine is like, great, yeah, thanks. I really needed to see that. And I just became more self-conscious as I continued to participate and then I just had to bolt.
So since your film is all about that kind of always measuring who's more successful than you are and how come you're not more successful, what did success mean to you growing up with your father, Mel White, who has been on our show a couple of times? And, we've talked to him and we've talked to you about him. So your father was best unknown, we could say, as a ghostwriter for books by evangelical leaders like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Jimmy and Tammy Faye Baker. But while he helped boost their success, he remained an invisible figure as a ghostwriter. But he was also invisible in the sense that he was gay and closeted during that period. He later not only came out, he became an activist. He became a minister to LGBTQ congregations. He started a group called Soul Force that was an LGBTQ group. So anyways, growing up with his father who who had to hide things about himself professionally and personally. What did success mean? When you looked at your father, did you see somebody very successful or somebody hidden and invisible?
Well, I definitely thought of him as a success and still do, as somebody who was endeavoring to find his authentic self and at much risk, personal and professional, you know, ended up having to speak his truth, for lack of a better cliche. And so I think of him as a success as a person. I admire him so much. I think as far as his own perceptions of success and like the more like external barometers of success, I think, like Brad, he's somebody who devoted the last half of his life to nonprofits and activism. And, you know, sometimes I think it's for him, I've seen that it's, you know, as he's retiring now and he has the money that he's left with to retire, I think there's moments where he questions, like, what did it all amount to? And what do I have to show for my life? And, you know, you can be praised and people can say, oh, wow, that's really, you know, noble of you or whatever. But, you know, I think there are people that are his age that have a lot more in just in terms of material wealth and success in that sense. And, you know, different ways to think about success. And when he was retiring, it made me think about his own feelings, maybe that, I don't know, maybe he wished he had more things to show, you know, for his life or something like that. And I if you asked him, he probably would have a much more wise kind of response to this, but that was my perception. And it made me think about what is the value of a life and what is happiness as you look back on the life and what's important.
The frame of the film is that the Ben Stiller character is taking his son on a college tour because his son is a senior in high school, and his son is a very good musician and composer, and all the people at his school say, like, you can get into Harvard, you could get into the top schools because you're that good. And so they're going on a tour of Harvard and Tufts, and they live in Sacramento, so this is, you know, it's a big trip to the East Coast. And why did you want to frame it on this, like, father-son college trip? You know, the wife and mother is home because she can't leave work. She has a government job, and she can't leave to get away for this trip.
I grew up in Southern California, and I went back east with my dad and looked at schools. I also went once with my mother, too. And I just remember that period of time was the first time where I had this intense status anxiety. And that getting into colleges and being accepted was the first kind of referendum on, you know, what has led you to this point, like your value and like what that means as far as your future. And my parents went to an unaccredited Bible college, and, you know, they were not up to date on the Fodor's list of what's the best college, or they didn't care really. They just wanted me to be happy. But I was at this preparatory school that was very competitive, and I just kind of lost the plot. It was like the first time in my life where I was just so spun out about, you know, if I get into this school, this means that, and, you know, like, and other people getting into other schools. And so I just, you know, as I was thinking about status and trying to find a location for this idea, it seemed like that might be the right time and place, you know, a kid who's about to apply to schools, and that his father, you know, I think for parents, it is also another time where, you know, it's a referendum on their parenting. And it just seemed like, even though I don't have kids, it just seemed like it was ripe for a lot of the ideas that I wanted to get at in the movie.
And Brad, the father, the Ben Stiller character, seems to in some ways not only be jealous of his old college friends, but to be jealous of his son, because his son is young and he's going to college and it's going to be an exciting experience. And his son is incredibly talented. His son has a gift. And have you seen that with people actually being jealous of their children?
Well, I think it's something that I mean, I don't want to, I was thinking about it in terms of my dad, and I think that because my dad was enlightened in a certain sense, and he, in the progression of like where his parents were at versus like the kind of parent he was to me, he really allowed me to, I don't know, try to just become the person I wanted to be, as opposed to put a lot of things on me. And so I haven't struggled in the certain ways that he had to struggle. And I think I know he is happy and proud of his role as a parent. And at the same time, I think sometimes I can see that because it was easier for me, because I didn't have his parents, I do sense that there's probably a part of him who, I don't know, maybe is jealous of that reality for me. And not like something that is like he doesn't wish the best for me, but just that, you know, I see it, you know, it's just a little bit of like, it's like, it was just easier for me because of him, you know? And I think...
You okay?
Yeah. No, I'm just, it's, yeah, I, for some reason, yeah, it's slightly emotional because I realized that, is like the whole heart of the movie is just me telling my dad that I love him. And, yeah, and I'm grateful for him, and I see him as a success. Yeah, anyway. Sorry, I just, it's like, it's, yeah, so I think you just hit on, like, to me, the movie is me, it's a love gift I'm trying to get at, in a sense, from my dad, is one way of looking at it. Sorry.
But I bet, unlike in the movie, that your father knows how you feel?
Yeah. Oh, he knows. And he's not as tortured as Brad. He's not Brad. It was just, you know, it's like you get at these little things and then you try to turn it into ideas and, you know, you try to make it more universal or I don't know, specific in some other way. And so, but yeah, at the core of it really is, getting at, like, you know, I do think that life is a grassroots campaign, you know, where success is about, you know, starting with yourself and then starting with the people that are the closest to you and building out from there, you know, like, and that if, you know, it's like, and I think that trying to find success from some kind of top-down campaign where it's like, oh, I won an Oscar, so that means I'm success, or, you know, I have fans and that means I'm a success, or I have all this wealth, that means I'm a success, or I'm the president of the United States and I, you know, like, I'm still tweeting late at night. Like, you just see that's not gonna, like, you know, like, that really, you have to, yeah, it starts with you and you have to, yeah, build out from just, you know, the dirt and the ground that you stand on.
So when you went on a college tour with your father, was your relationship good enough at the time that you didn't have to, like, try to separate? You know how, like, some kids at that age are kind of embarrassed about their parents?
No,
And you go into college and you don't want to be judged on who your parents are. You want to be judged on who you are. So, you know, you want to separate yourself from your parents.
Right. Oh, no, I was at my worst. I was convinced that, like, anything that my dad's very social and genial and extroverted and would interact with everyone. And I was just, like, in my head being like, every bad encounter in my mind was going to be remembered forever. And, like, I was never gonna be able to go to this school. And I was like, and the character in the movie that is played by Austin Abrams is, like, a lot more wise and grounded than I was, but he, you know, I thought Austin, he was so, when he came in and auditioned, I was like, oh wow, he just nails this certain kind of thing where I think kids at a certain age, right when they're about to leave the house, it's like everything their parents do is like nails on a chalkboard, but they don't really want to get into it because it just exacerbates the issue. So they just kind of like shut down and become kind of monosyllabic and just sort of like, it's like, you just sense that they're just trying to survive until they're free. And I just felt like that withholding thing he was doing, but without being petulant or being kind of, I don't know, like, I don't know, argumentative, was exactly the tone that I was like, that just felt so true to me. And he just brought that naturally.
There's a scene where Stiller's character imagines his son being very successful. And he imagines his son on Jimmy Kimmel's show. And his son is like telling funny stories and then starting to tell stories about how crazy his father is. Ben Stiller is just like lying in bed watching his son imagineering this is all in his imagination, but he's lying in bed watching his son on TV talk about how crazy his father is. And it ends up being just like a horrifying experience for him. And I wonder where that comes from for you.
Well, you mean, has that happened? Well, I mean, I was actually on...
Yeah, go ahead.
I was on Jimmy Kimmel and talking about just a funny story about my childhood and going to a religious summer camp where they would have rapture drills and various things that, like, traumatized me. And it was played as just comic anecdote, you know. But I know that my dad the next day was like, you know, that makes me look like I, you know, sent you to some, you know. He was, like, kind of ruffled, I guess, by it, because I think he took it as, like, you know, it made it sound like I had crazy parents that would allow, you know, me to be in a situation like that. And so, yeah, there was a sort of a moment from life that's drawn from, which is, you know, I did have a crazy upbringing because I was in a kind of conservative Christian world. But my dad, you know, straddled it in a very, you know, my parents weren't crazy. But yeah, I think my dad is a little bit prickly about all of that, because I think he was a great parent, but I was exposed to a lot of dogma and some weird stuff.
What is a rapture drill?
A rapture drill is when we would wake up in the morning and all the campers would get together and they would be like, rapture! And then you'd, like, raise your arms to the sky as if, like, it's like a fire drill, but it was a rapture drill. So, like, all the good Christians will get, you know, I don't know, beamed up to heaven, and all of the sinners would be left to fend in the apocalypse.
So in rapture drills, do you imagine yourself, do you always imagine yourself being lifted up to heaven?
That was the whole problem with religious summer camp. Because I just, the thing about me, I was just never, I never had that moment where I was like, I got it. I didn't know, they would have these like former junkies come and speak to us and, you know, over in front of a campfire and tell us how they found Jesus under a bridge and changed their life. And then they would tell us to go out into the dark and accept Jesus into our hearts. And then we would all be sent out into the night. And, like, I would be like, what is going on? And, like, I would go look for my friends, and then I'd be like, hey, you want to go hang out? And they'd be like, go away, I'm accepting Jesus into my heart. And I would be like, am I the seed of the devil? And, like, I really felt like I was, I never really felt like I was going to get raptured, to answer your question, no.
So were those rapture drills like an existential crisis for you?
Yeah, no, it was like, I remember really being tortured. And I was like, I'd send letters home, like, get me out of here. Like, it was very, you know, it was cultish, but, like, on such a mass scale, it's like, it's beyond a cult.
Well, I always find it interesting that, you know, your father managed to stay a Christian and maintain his beliefs, even though he threw out a lot of the things that he thought were really negative and wrong, like the prohibitions against being gay or lesbian, because he came out and he wasn't going to deal with that anymore. And he participated in churches that, you know, welcomed LGBTQ people and built the church around those people. So, you know, he didn't have to abandon his faith, even though he abandoned some principles that he was taught in the version of the faith that he was brought up with and that the people around him espoused. And you didn't throw out, I don't know if you still go to church or not, but you maintain some kind of, you know, spiritual force in your life through, you know, meditation and studying Buddhism and, you know, whatever you've built around that.
Well, it's definitely taken me, I mean, I'm now in my 40s, it's taken me a couple decades to realize how much I did get out of certain elements of this Christian upbringing. And I'm grateful for a lot of it. Certainly the stuff that I got from my parents. You know, my mom is involved in really a sort of civic-minded Christian church and does a lot of great things. And I admire her and her friends and her church. And my dad, he instilled in us values that I think, you know, are really positive. You know, he really believed in Jesus as someone who walked in solidarity with the poor and the outcasts of society. And he always, you know, it was the kind of do unto others as you would have unto you, and this feeling that Jesus could come back in any form. And even before he came out and became an activist, he was very much in solidarity with civil rights. And, you know, so there was a conservative part of it, but there was also a very kind of, I don't know, something very enlightened too about it, a real spiritual side that really was inclusive, and that I really still appreciate and I guess draw on in my life still.
Well, Mike White, thanks so much for coming back on Fresh Air. I always love talking with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry. I love talking to you.
Mike White wrote and directed the new film Brad Status, starring Ben Stiller. It opens in theaters September 15th.